This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on July 28, 2009. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
We begin with draft advisory opinion 2009-13.
Mr. Chairman, the agenda document 0942B is a late submitted document.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda document number 09-42-B.
Thank you very much. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes 5-0. Commissioner Weintraub has recused herself from this matter. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. At the open meeting held on July 16, the Commission considered three drafts responding to a request for advisory opinion filed on behalf of the BlackRock Group. Consideration of these drafts, designated as drafts A, B, and revised draft A, has been held over from the Commission's July 16 open meeting to today's open meeting. Since the July 16 open meeting, the Commission has released another draft, designated as draft C, and presented before you as agenda document 0942B. The Commission has received one comment since the July 16 open meeting. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Commissioner Bowerly?
I don't have a question for counsel, but thank you for the presentation. We are back here on this advisory opinion, and we appreciate the extension by the requester to do so. I don't have any questions for the requester. We have a new document, which unfortunately I won't be able to support. Last time I indicated that I was going to support draft B, and I think there appeared to be two votes for that, and there appeared to be two votes for a different draft. And so I had hoped we could put together a document that reflected the overlap of those two. And unfortunately, I don't think draft C, in my view, captures the overlap. I think it goes a little further than that. So. I will again be supporting draft B, and the chairman and I had attempted our version of what we thought was the overlap, but we decided not to make that draft blue because we didn't feel there was more than two votes for it. We didn't have any indication there was more than two votes for it. So at the appropriate time, I will be supporting draft B, and obviously my colleagues will support whichever of the drafts that they want to support, and our counsel's office will have to inform the requester of, as they usually do, when that happens in these situations. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further comment? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Draft C, I thought, was based on the discussion that we had at the table, and we as the collective we, and I'm including the requester and counsel and everyone, on the issue before us, which is primarily whether or not a political committee might exist here, where you have what are essentially private individuals, although they're using corporate entities. A prior AO from just a few weeks ago said that because it's their personal money, they're essentially individuals. So whether individuals who hired the same consultant, who then may or may not share information as to what the other individuals are doing and on their spending, could become a political committee. And it seemed, based on the discussion last week, that there was a sense that maybe they are a political committee because they are a group of persons under the statute. I'm not sure that ends the analysis, because the statute, of course, has been limited by the Supreme Court and other courts in light of a number of Supreme Court cases. But what I'm struggling with are two things. First, if it is a political committee, what does that mean? And we talked about what, if any, limits may apply. And it seems like the thought last week was that there would not be contribution limits, which, you know, I agree with that result, because I don't think this is a political committee. But let's assume it is. I'm having trouble with where the political committee begins and ends, if there's not contribution limits, certainly there can't be expenditure limits. To be a political committee, you have to receive contributions or make expenditures in excess of $1,000. And what I'm trying to find out and sort of get my mind around is what actually triggers political committee status here. Is it the proposed spending? And if so, are there contributions being made? I'm just trying. I'm struggling with the sense of where the committee begins and ends. If draft B opines that it may be a political committee, I'm trying to get a sense of the contours of where that line is. And if anyone has a sense, they can chime in. But I'm just trying to see where the lines begin and end on where the political committee actually happens. What triggers it?
Commissioner Parley.
Well, I think that's why draft B says that the conduct described by the requester may trigger the status. And some of the questions that you're asking, I think, aren't properly before us because we have the vendor before us and not the LLCs. And if, you know, I'm not sure. It was my understanding that your view was that there was not a political committee created by this activity as the requester described it. It was my view that it likely would be. So I thought that was our source of disagreement, and so I didn't think there were five votes for saying that this was political. There was a political committee created. And I just, with one respect to one of your questions about the expenditures, the request tells us that they are going to, each LLC is going to spend over $1,000. So I don't think that was an issue presented. I think they were asking about the activity that they were proposing by the part of the vendor. And this is unusual because we only have the vendor before us and not the LLCs. And I think that some of these questions we would need to hear from the LLCs before we could opine on what those things meant.
I agree that this is a different sort of AO because it's rare for someone to come in ahead of time, particularly on this issue, political committee status, and actually ask the question. It's also different because what you have are individuals, essentially. Let me ask this: if the view is that it may be a political committee based upon the facts presented, the question I have is why? Statutorily, what's the trigger? Is it the spending, or is it which side is it?
As explained in draft B, I think we went over this all last week, and I'm happy to engage in as much conversation as possible. But I don't really think this is going to result in any productive change to the situation we're now in. As explained in draft B, my view, these activities, as explained, create a group of persons, which would then may likely be a political committee under the statute.
Okay. Let me ask this then. This requester, who's BlackRock, are they part of that political committee?
As in draft B, no, they are not part of. It is the LLCs who become the committee.
Okay. Because what I'm struggling with is and we're not going to resolve it today, but it seems to me, and maybe I asked the requester this. Assume this is a political committee. You have individuals spending their own money, so that's an expenditure. How does the money get in the committee if they're not giving the money to anyone else? It's sort of the Big Bang theory of political committees. You're going to have more than $1,000 of expenditures, but you're not going to have contributions.
Well, I think that's the rub of the issue here on the political committee status issue. Each LLC is not going to be contributing money to a central entity, to a unified group. Each LLC, an individual, is going to be spending his or her own money.
Right.
And one of the things that I'd like to point out is that in advisory opinion 2009-2, in a supplemental response from Perkins Coie, talking about the LLC that was approved by a 5-0 vote by the commission, that LLC had established a website to recruit like-minded organizations to share similar experiences, to engage in similar activities. Also, they were going to receive advice from vendors before putting out the communications and leaving the sole discretion, or the, they called it exclusive, but it's the ultimate control, in the single member of the LLC. That is not a political committee as determined by the commission. This is the same type of situation. It's just here we have the vendor who is asking the question to engage in the activities that are already permissible under 2009-2. It's just that the vendor will have multiple clients. Factually, there is no difference between the LLCs that BlackRock Group will be providing services to and the LLC as described in the advisory opinion request and the advisory opinion issued by the commission in 2009-2.
Who was the requester in 9-2?
That was the True Patriot Network.
Okay. See, the thing I'm struggling with, it seems to me the only spending is by the individuals through their LLCs, and even though it's an LLC, that seems to be a red herring because the True Patriot Network, AO, already says that that's not really a corporate entity for purposes of the Act. It's actually individual money. So you have individuals spending money, and my fear is that if your client goes out and does this, somebody may file a complaint, and then there's an enforcement action. Then we have this discussion behind closed doors, and we decide, we debate political committee status in the enforcement context, not ahead of time in an open meeting, which is why I find this AO so intriguing. It gives the public a chance to see how the commission deals with political committee status, you know, out in the open and not after the fact, you know, 4 or 5 years from now. But the issue I see is potential limitations, and it seems like if there is a political committee, someone will make the argument at some point in the future that there's a $5,000 limit in here somewhere, and that's going to end up being imposed on the spending of the individuals, which to me makes the contribution and the expenditure the same thing. And when that happens, well, you know, those who are, you know, students of Supreme Court precedent knows what happens when that happens, right? That kind of really, you know, once the distinction between contributions and expenditures evaporates, that really becomes a very sticky situation for the commission. But I don't think we have to reach that issue because, and Mr. Chairman, if I just a couple more minutes and then I'll yield and we can just move on. But I think it's important for those who read transcripts or listen to things to understand where we're coming from, because if we try to go and impose a limit on this, that's essentially, to me, a backdoor way to impose a limit on spending. And I'm going to read from Buckley, where it says, by contrast with the limitation upon expenditures for political expression, which, of course, are unlimited, says the court previously in the opinion, a limitation upon the amount that any one person or group may contribute to a candidate or political committee entails only a marginal restriction upon the contributor's ability to engage in free communication. A contribution serves as a general expression of support for the candidate and his views, but does not communicate the underlying basis for the support. The quantity of communication by the contributor does not increase perceptibly with the size of his contribution, since the expression rests solely on the undifferentiated symbolic act of contributing. At most, the size of the contribution provides a very rough index of the intensity of the contributor's support for the candidate. That's the whole shooting match when it comes to upholding contribution limits on political committees. Here, none of those concerns are present. There's no contributions to candidates. There's no corruption or appearance thereof, unless you buy sort of an aggregation of wealth sort of thing, which the Supreme Court has only accepted with respect to corporate and union speech, actually corporate speech. The union, I don't think, has been tested. This is not just a symbolic act. It's their direct spending. As I understand it, the LLCs are going to be expressing their own views. The money's not going to be pooled. So it seems like their own spending. So I can't see how a $5,000 limit would apply. I guess if a political committee is formed, you essentially take your independent expenditure report, staple them together, and reformat them and file as a political committee, I guess. And then CalMed, which I talked about last time but didn't really read in full, and that's, you know, 5-4. And the majority four justices draw a very clear distinction between imposing limits on political committee contributions, saying it's distinguishable from expenditures made jointly by groups of individuals in order to express common political views. That seems to be what you're proposing, that your client would advise others on how to do. And then Justice Blackmun's concurrence, which is the swing vote in this case upholding contribution limits on political committees, states, and I quote, "I stress, however, that this analysis has suggested a different result would follow if 441A1C were applied to contributions to a political committee established for the purpose of making independent expenditures rather than contributions to candidates." So even if it's a political committee, I don't see how contribution limits apply, which is why I'm asking the question about what triggers the political committee. Because the requesters ask, could the political committee arise? And if the answer to that is, well, yes, maybe, I think we owe it to the requester to flesh that out as to what that actually means when the statute defines political committee in terms of contributions and expenditures. Now, if what we're telling the requester is that we need the actual spenders of the money to come in and ask, that's a different story. And I guess I can, you know, we take the issues as they come. But I don't really see this issue as something that's not – that's different from what is in this request. I see it as the same issue. And so that's why I'm having trouble figuring out where the committee begins and ends, because they want to do something. If they go and do it, what then happens – in the enforcement context, do they have to come back in with another request, or do they just file as a political committee and there's no limits? I'm just trying to see if I can understand the contours.
And Mr. Commissioner, just to point out,
or maybe what do you think?
Let me just get control of this. This is all new to all of us, but the basic idea behind the having someone here is to ask clarifying questions. So let's come from that direction if I can. And keep control of how we're going to communicate.
Appreciate
with each
that, Mr. Chairman. Right, let me ask a question, maybe target it, and then we can wrap up. What do you think your client can do based upon all this?
Well, first of all, the basis for the request itself. I mean, in 2009-2, the advisory opinion that we reference in our request basically lays out an LLC that the requester represented. The group sign-up page on TPN's website is very new, has not been fully implemented yet. They currently do not have any groups who have signed up. They intend, as the feature becomes more active, to connect to different groups with each other to work on similar projects or to learn one another's experiences. Now, this was a request from an LLC that was requesting confirmation that they could run independent expenditures. So they were looking to connect with different groups with the LLC on similar projects. And so you have an advisory opinion that already protects the limited liability companies that are established by the individuals who want to run the independent expenditures or sponsor them. The BlackRock Group advisory opinion request is simply confirming that the vendor is not going to be placed in jeopardy if they have multiple clients engaging in the same activity. The request from TPN clearly states that they contemplate connecting with like-minded groups to engage in similar activities. They also say that the sole member of the group is going to be the final decision maker on all TPN actions and positions, including any political communications that TPN makes, with employees and consultants playing advisory roles. That is what BlackRock Group intends to do for its LLC
clients. Bill, I don't want to cut you off. Let's just answer my question. The question is, what do you think you can do and not do? Do you think you're a political committee? I mean, what are we taking from all this?
We don't believe we are a political committee.
Well, based upon the discussion here, though.
Based upon the discussion here, I think that there is some doubt whether political committee status would be triggered.
But let's say it is triggered. Let's say hypothetically it is triggered.
Well, that's a difficult question, because nobody is contributing money to a central entity. There is no money that's going to be taken from one LLC, deposited into a central bank account. No LLC is going to be contributing money to another LLC. All that you're going to be having is an advisory role played by BlackRock Group that's going to basically give general strategic advice.
On people's spending.
On people's spending of their own funds.
All right.
Spending of funds where the member retains the exclusive control, or the ultimate control, over what's going to be said in the communications.
Which we learned last week, there's no legal distinction between that those two words.
Right.
It's the same. Let's call them functional equivalent, just because that's an in-vogue term right now. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Yes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
I just have a quick question, just seeking clarification about how BlackRock intends to act. In some of the comments that we received in response to your request, the concern was raised that the proposed activities would, quote, amount to BRG coordinating and controlling the spending by the LLCs, end quote. At least raising the specter that that BlackRock would, in essence, be a mastermind, that wealthy individuals might seek you out, or maybe BlackRock would seek wealthy individuals out, and basically they would give the green light, and BlackRock would determine which races it was going to should have money spent on them, the types of communications, the language, the timing, location, and so forth, and then send the bill, the resulting bill, to the wealthy individual. Is this how BlackRock intends to act? Because I didn't get that from the request, but I wanted some clarification about how you envisioned, as representative for BlackRock, how they plan to operate.
BlackRock Group is going to play an advisory role. BlackRock is going to give strategic and tactical advice on how best to communicate each LLC's views. As we said in the last meeting, there's not going to be a binding vote between the LLCs regarding who's going to air ads in which race, concerning which types of candidates. But as BlackRock's group, you know, as their advisory role in connection with these multiple LLCs is developed, we anticipate that people are going to say, ask questions of, you know, where should I air advertisements? You know, what's the most effective way for me to communicate my views? Is it direct mail? Is it phone? Is it radio? Is it TV? And that BlackRock will advise those LLCs regarding how most effectively to communicate their messages. Now, it may be, as we presented in the request, that there's going to be multiple LLCs airing ads in the same race concerning the same candidate. I think one of the things that a good strategic consultant is going to say is, you know, if you want to run TV, that's great, but somebody else is already doing TV. Maybe you want to consider radio. Maybe you want to consider mail. Maybe you want to consider phone. But that is not a binding. The advice is not binding. I mean, the LLCs are going to retain ultimate control over what they say, how they say it, and when they're going to say it. It's going to be an advisory role similar to TPN and the consultants that it was receiving advice from. And also, I might add, the coordination with the other groups that they work in, you know, intend to engage in similar projects, as was represented by the requester. And so I think that what we're not going to have here is a binding coordination between the LLCs regarding what to say, how to say, and when to say it. We are going to have BlackRock Group advising people about how to best express their political views, and it's their political views.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Okay. So it doesn't sound like this is a situation where basically the LLCs will just be delegating to BlackRock all decisions about what races are going to be, what races, what issues. Again, the mode and method of communication, that they're playing an advisory role. There's not some sort of a grand orchestrator role.
No.
Is that correct?
No. I mean, especially based upon the TPN advisory opinion request, in order for the LLCs to be permissible under the Acting Commission regulations, the member needs to retain exclusive or ultimate control over what they say, when they say, and how they say it. And that's not what we're asking.
So, John, I'll just wrap up my comments. I explained in some detail last week why I support a draft A and why I don't think that the actions that are being proposed in this advisory opinion request rise to the level of to trigger political committee status. And I agree with the questions, concerns that Commissioner McGann raised, that there's a threshold question about not only is this a group of persons, but is this a group of persons that has made over $1,000 in expenditures or received over $1,000 in contributions? And that's because if there's going to be some sort of conclusion that this enterprise is a political committee, then I think we owe it to requester to be able to explain to them which of those two thresholds. Is it just the spending? In which case, I guess it would just be a pure disclosure. Or are we going to say that spending by LLCs is also a contribution? And as Commissioner McGann indicated, once we start equating contributions with spending, then we run into some problems with Supreme Court precedent. So, I'm also concerned that if we were to adopt the approach that's set forth in Draft B, that would raise all sorts of questions. the dinner group hypothetical that Commissioner Hunter raised last week, where friends sitting down at a table who discuss how they want to spend money, you know, to impact races, is their kind of informal discussion saying, I want to spend it on one on particular race through, you know, radio, and someone else saying that I want to spend through television. And just the fact that they're having that discussion, does that create a political committee out of them for PACs that already discuss, if they engage in a little chit chat, are we going to create basically mega PACs out of those organizations? And what are the implications for vendors that have multiple clients? I think all of these those are serious questions that if we were to go down the road of draft B, I think that could have very far-ranging and very serious impacts. And and I don't think that, for one thing, I don't think that the case law, I don't think that the law supports that conclusion. And for that reason, I continue to support draft A.
Thank you. Commissioner Hunter.
I, too, continue to support draft A for many of the same reasons that my colleagues have discussed. And as requester points out, the exact language in 2009-2 that you're referring to is, Mr. Hanauer will be the final decision maker on all TPN actions, although TPN's employees and consultants might advise TPN in the making of these communications. So even if it were something less formal than requester just discussed, and for example, one of those consultants had lunch with a different member LLC the day before and sort of relayed some of that conversation to Mr. Hanauer, is he now a group of persons? And I think it's very dangerous, even before you get to this sort of formal arrangement on the website that you were talking about, you know, any kind of casual conversation, someone reading the newspaper even. I mean, at what point does someone become a group of persons that's coordinating or sharing information? I think it's a very, very dangerous line to draw. And also, I went back last night and reread the political committee status supplemental explanation and justification that the FEC put out on February 7th, 2007, with this request in mind. And I don't find anything in here that would be helpful, in my view, to requestor in determining whether or not they would meet political committee status based on some of the conversations that have happened over the past two public sessions. And the only thing that, you know, sort of the crux of this document, in my mind, is the following on page 5597. Determining political committee status under FECA as modified by the Supreme Court requires an analysis of both an organization's specific conduct, whether it received $1,000 in contributions or made $1,000 in expenditures, as well as its overall conduct, whether its major purpose is federal campaign activity. So again, to me, that's sort of the crux of this whole document, and that's not useful for the kind of request that is before us today. And so I'm not sure where one would go for any kind of guidance on this type of situation. I think it puts requestor and those who want to participate in novel ways in the political process at a real disadvantage. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Further comment, Commissioner McGann.
I think to follow up on what Commissioner Hunter said, I think what it means is you either have to check in first before you speak, or you take your chances and see what happens years from now in a MER. And that's frustrating, and that's something that is tough. I think part of this is caused by past commission action on political committee status, where in lieu of a rule, the major purpose test was to be done on a case-by-case basis. Some had supported a rule. I think, you know, whether we could fashion a rule, of course, is a whole other question. But, you know, without real guidance on that issue, it's tough enough. But we're not even talking major purpose here. We're talking contributions and expenditures. And something you said about whether this is a group of persons and this is, you know, dangerous for them and that sort of thing. You know, CalMed, we forget sometimes to read the full caption. And it's California Medical Association versus Federal Election Commission. I mean, the FEC was a party to this. This is the U.S. Supreme Court drawing the distinction, at least how I read the case, between what you can impose limits on and what you can't. You know, it's not CalMed Association versus Leak or Nixon or some state AG or some state law, right? This is the FEC as a party. So we can read the statute, we can read rulemakings and all that kind of thing, But when the FEC is a party to a case before the U.S. Supreme Court, I think we have to read that. I don't think it's optional. I don't think Supreme Court opinions are opinion. I think they're law. I think we all agree with that. But sometimes I'm not sure. But, you know, there is a distinction here, and maybe the best way to attack this is fall back to the parts that we agree on, which is a draft that Commissioner Bowerly has prepared, although we haven't made it public, so we can probably circulate that in short order, I hope. And maybe the answer is when your client gets some clients, one of those clients come back and we flesh out the maybe. Because I hear it may be a political committee, and may means it maybe isn't a political committee. I think it depends on the facts, and the problem is that is increased expense and that kind of thing. But what I'm hearing is there is hope that there is something you can do that makes you not a political committee. Maybe you already are, but I'm not sure, again, where the line is, because I know where I am. But that's my way of trying to be constructive and bring this to a slow, lethargic end. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Further questions? I'm going to have just a couple questions from you. How do you plan to bill? Suppose you have 30 or 50 people who are in a room from different LLCs. How do you plan to bill them?
Well, basically, it would just be you would bill each committee its proportionate time. I mean, you know, it depends upon, you know, I don't anticipate there's going to be 30 or 50 people in a room.
Well, we don't know what to anticipate. From our vantage point, we don't know what to anticipate.
Well, I think that you have basically what we have here is the same LLCs that 2009-2 addresses. And BlackRock Group is going to use the commercially reasonable method to make sure that each LLC is paying for his or her own services and not supplementing the services that are provided to any other LLC.
Well, if I understand it correctly, there's a potential pooling. You will, in fact, manage other consultants serving the same set of LLCs, such as pollsters, media production, media placement, direct mail, phone vendors. You're going to suppose there's 20 or 30 LLCs you're working with. You're going to bill them all 1/20th of that, or how do you? I guess the point that I want to make is, for concern for me, breaking new ground in some regards. What's a group of persons? And yes, we don't have a regulation. Whether we could fashion one, I don't know. But it would lead us into conversations like, when do they become more in sync with each other? When do they develop even informally a common course of action? When do they start to begin to develop teamwork, or maybe even unified approaches toward spending, and where that might lead? And I just see here. Basically one entity that might be similar to an orchestra, where one doesn't have to necessarily play the guitar in a particular tune, but overall they're all sitting there to get the same music done. And I think when we get to a degree like that, it is a matter of degree to some degree, and I think we say likely because there's some fairly open-ended representations about what's going to happen. So I'm reluctant to go any further today than say it likely would be an LLC or a political committee formed under the facts that we have. As you say, maybe as we go along and the facts get refined, then we'll find ourselves being able to slice the bread a little thinner. I'm not sure all these examples work, but...
No, I...
Commissioner McGann.
Yeah, I appreciate the symphonic reference. you know, the larger the group, sometimes the easier it is to be a group of persons. So, you know, it's... I guess the question I have, Mr. Chairman, is something that you said. Let's assume they are a political committee, right? Let's assume they are a group of persons. I'm still hung up on what is the significance of that? Are they limited in what they can spend? Do we have? I mean, can we give the request or anything on that issue here today? Because if it's simply disclosure, I mean, they may say, okay, we'll file as a political committee, and they're already, if they're doing IEs, meaning express advocacy, they're going to file IE reports. Unless something changes in the courts, that's the law, and they're going to file that. So I think there's already disclosure, and if they file as a political committee, you know, that's some more disclosure, but not really. But I'm still hung up on where are there any limits on what they can do when it comes to use of money.
Well, if you're asking me to answer a question that's not before us, let's wait till we have a question formally before us. But if we want to look at the implications of who's part of a political committee and what their limitations are, then I think that's where we have to start looking.
Okay.
I mean, we have one comment that says to allow its clients to pool money for independent expenditures in excess of $5,000 limit is really the goal here. I don't know that that's the case, but that would be something we'd take up if we found out there was a political committee. We'd have to decide where to go, and that's where we, unfortunately, in some regards, are on a case-by-case basis on a number of these questions.
If I could, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the case-by-case basis, but that's with respect to major purpose. Whether or not someone's made a contribution or an expenditure is not a case, cannot be a case-by-case determination.
Well, right? Maybe a case-by-case basis on what's a group of persons. And we have
right.
to find that amongst ourselves.
But that group of persons still has to make a contribution or an expenditure in excess of $1,000. There's still sort of a black or white answer in there somewhere, right? Now, maybe the answer is that one of the LLC's potential clients has to come in and ask they want to, you know, spend, but then they have to telegraph what they're spending and all that kind of thing, which really doesn't seem wholly consistent with what the court has said about First Amendment. But, you know, you do what we can here. But to me, the whole shooting match are the limits, right? Because that's the theme of the comments. And that, to me, is an issue that's before us, because you simply say it might be a political committee without explaining the significance of that or how that actually is triggered is really kind of a murky answer. And maybe the answer is they come back with a more specific request when they actually have a real spending situation, and we decide at that point whether there's a limit. Maybe that's the way we solve this one, and then, you know, we'll get the same comments, and then we decide the issue another day. But maybe we can at least tell this consultant that they could try to develop their business, and then there's still potential that this is not a political committee, depending on whatever. I mean, at the end of the day, they're a commercial vendor looking to make a profit. They want to pitch clients. You know, I can appreciate all that, having been, you know, in private practice, and the chair can probably appreciate that as well. You know.
Clients are essential.
Yep. And clients like to know what you can and can't do for them when you pitch them. And I think that's part of why they want an AO, is they want to say, look, we can provide this service to you. The FEC says it's okay. And I'm trying to, and that's, to me, the real purpose of the request. And I'm reading something into that, of course, but I'm trying to just pull whatever I can out of whatever I can here to give whatever sort of guidance we can so they can move forward. And if it is that they have to pitch some clients, get a real client, and then the real client has to make the request before they spend money, so be it. But I guess the question in general for whoever wants to discuss it is, if that happens and if they come in with some specifics, is there a chance that there is not a political committee here? Is it really a maybe a political committee, or do we already think this is a political committee? Is there still some daylight here for these folks to come in with more specifics?
Well, I guess we'll just have to see. I can't tell you how much daylight there is until we take something that's more concrete. But I don't think we should say no. I think a lot of this is a matter of degree, like major purposes, when you get down to it and we start weighing factors and we come up with our own approach that hopefully we can get four votes for sometimes. And so we'll just have to see. Any further comment? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my inquiry is where we are procedurally. Commissioner McGann raised the prospect of perhaps considering Commissioner Bowerly's draft that hasn't gone blue, or I suppose at this point we could also instruct counsel to notify the requester that we were not able to reach a decision with respect to question two. I just wanted to ask him. I guess we could ask counsel and also inquire of my colleagues which procedural route we'd like to take in order to wrap this one up.
Any further comment on that from the Office of General Counsel on procedure?
I think it very much depends upon the will of the commission. If there's a belief that there could be four more votes for the compromise draft that Commissioner Bowerly described, we would be happy to work with you all to circulate that on a tally basis. to have it considered. If not, and there's disagreement here today, then we'd also be happy to, or we would, advise the requester that the commission has been unable to answer the advisory opinion request.
Commissioner Bowerly.
I think we are back where we were 2 weeks ago and many hours and lots of thinking later. We appear to have two votes for draft B and three votes for another draft. I'm not sure exactly which one. And, you know, we could certainly take those votes and simply have the council's office send the response that they typically do when that happens.
Let's take a 5-minute break.
Lays out exactly what they want to do. And I think that if the commission deadlocks on one question, question number three, which goes to the communications between the LSCs, perhaps is a place where the commission can put a finer point on what the contours are of the permissible activity, so that at least my client has some guidance about what they can talk to its client, their clients about, and what type of activities that they can engage in. And so giving them some certainty as they move forward, which is the reason that they submitted the advisory opinion request in the first place.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Procedurally, there's a motion before us. So if, is there any desire to? We have, as I procedurally count, I count four votes and then a question.
I said aye.
You said aye.
Sort of.
Okay, the motion passes 5-0. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Vice Chairman, we have some late submitted documents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we suspend the rules on the timely submission of documents in order to consider agenda documents number 09-54, 09-54A, and 09-54B.
Thank you. And I will, we are on the Mercedes-Benz AO. And Mr. Barron, if you'd like to join us, it would be great. Welcome. As you can tell, we're still experimenting with this process.
Seems like a wonderful experiment.
All in favor of the motion to consider the agenda documents 0954, 0954A, and 0954B? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Motion passes 6-0. And counsel, Mr. Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning to the commissioners. Agenda documents 0954, 0954A, and then its addendum at 0954B respond to a request for advisory opinion filed on behalf of Mercedes-Benz USA LLC, or MBUSA, and Sterling Truck Corporation. MBUSA and Sterling are both subsidiaries of Daimler North America Corporation, whose parent is German company Daimler AG. They ask a number of questions related to the establishment, administration, and financing of an SSF, including whether Sterling may serve as the connected organization for the proposed SSF, whether MBUSA may use its personnel and resources to administer the SSF, if those administrative costs may be paid from MBUSA's External Affairs and Public Policy Cost Center, and finally, whether the name of the SSF may be abbreviated to Daimler PAC. Both drafts conclude that Sterling may serve as the connected organization for the SSF, and that MBUSA may use its personnel and resources to administer it. Both drafts also conclude that the name of the SSF may be abbreviated to Daimler PAC. The drafts diverge, however, on whether payment of the SSF's administrative costs may come from MBUSA's EAPP cost center. The commission received one comment on the drafts, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you all may have. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Any questions, comments? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a question for Mr. Barron. In the comments you submitted after the drafts went blue, you take pretty serious exception with how the alternative draft refers to the arrangement by which MBUSA retains a portion of its domestically generated revenues to cover the cost center expenses. You take exception with that being referred to as a reimbursement. I was just wondering if you could further explain, you know, factually what, you know, flesh out what that arrangement is and give us a, you know, a larger explanation about why that isn't a reimbursement.
Well, I'll be glad to, Commissioner. As laid out in the original request, the company seeks to keep track of expenses and accounting in order to calculate profit centers and margins and sales goals. So I think the simplest way to describe this is when vehicles come into the United States from Stuttgart and Germany to be sold here, they have a certain cost. Those vehicles are sold in the United States, many of them, hopefully more in the future, and it generates income. And then there's a transmittal of money to Germany. All right, so up to this point, we have no money coming here from anywhere. We have money being raised as a result of sales, and then money being transferred to Germany. And when that money goes back to Germany, there is an accounting of these cost centers, including EAPP, and whatever the budget for that cost center is, that amount is deducted from the money that comes out of these sales back to Germany. So there is this imputation in the alternative draft that somehow there's a reimbursement of something coming from abroad to the United States when actually it's just the reverse.
It's just a what, sir?
I'm sorry?
Actually, it's just a what? I missed that word.
It's just a reverse.
Reverse. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yeah, if I could just... Have you seen the errata document that was that went blue this morning, where in the alternative draft there's now a new language that's included that says the practical effect of this proposal is that Daimler AG would be reimbursing MBUSA LLC for costs that include the administration of the SSF. So no money flows from the foreign parent, as it was described in some substantial detail in the request, and also as you just explained, no money is flowing from Germany to the United States to pay for these costs. And the alternative draft is now going to make the argument that even though there's not that flow of money, for all intents and purposes, the practical effect, or again, to borrow a functional equivalent, that this is the functional equivalent of reimbursement. And I just wanted to give you the opportunity to respond to that.
I have not seen this morning's new document, but it sounds like that the alternative, if amended that way, would be both factually and legally incorrect.
Further comments? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, of course, this is the crux of the issue. For many years, there was actually a debate on the Commission as to whether it was appropriate for the domestic subsidiaries of foreign-owned companies to even have SSFs. And there were commissioners who, for many years, would vote against any AO that endorsed that. And I don't believe there's anybody who is making that argument today. I don't want to speak for my colleagues, but I don't believe that there is any commissioner who takes that viewpoint today. I think that is well established that the domestic employees who are U.S. citizens and their company happens to be taken over, as in this one actually provides a perfect example of it, by a foreign company, those employees still can participate, can pool their resources through a PAC and participate in the political process that way. And obviously they can make individual contributions. So that's not on the table at all. We're not talking about that. We're only talking about how the administrative expenses of that PAC are going to be paid for. And, you know, if we are factually in error, then I certainly would want to hear about that. But the request itself says, and, you know, with all due respect to my colleague, you didn't read the sentence that came before that quoted the request. The request says when this cost center, the EAPP, incurs expenses, MBUSA pays them from its general treasury and periodically invoices Daimler AG to recoup those expenses. So maybe you can help me out here and explain to me the difference between recoupment and reimbursement. Because, and let me just, this is what I understand, and if I'm wrong, I want to know about it. But what it sounds like to me is that the domestic subsidiary owes money to the foreign parent, and the foreign parent deducts from the amount that is owed the expenses of administering the PAC. And that's where we come to the conclusion that, well, whether the foreign parent is actually writing a check for this or whether they're just deducting the amount that would otherwise be due, the effect appears to be the same. So if that's not true, I would welcome that clarification.
Well, I would direct your attention to page 3 of the original request.
Oh, that's what I was quoting from.
It talks about these costs are all accounted for on a monthly basis. MBUSA typically makes a payment to Daimler for the vehicles and products it was allocated for U.S. sales. That's what I just described. EAPP expenses that have been invoiced to Daimler are netted against the monthly payments, which means that they're deducted. So the amount of the payment for the cars and the products is reduced by the EAPP quote expenses, which have already been paid by MBUSA here in the United States. So they're not sending that money back. What they are doing is they're retaining the money that was spent to pay for the administrative costs. So it's a recoupment only in an accounting sense, and I think that this is set forth, stated further, that this process is a matter of internal accounting. Daimler does not physically reimburse the Daimler EAPP expenses by check, wire transfer, or by other means.
No, I understand that part, but I guess if I owe you $10 and you say, well, but...
I don't owe you $10. I owe you for a car. All right? You haven't sent me any money. You sent me a car. And it's worth $100, you know, for cash.
Wow,
for
that's a good deal. Can I buy a
cash
car for $100?
Cash for clunkers, yeah. And,
it's a Mercedes for $100. Now
we're
like
talking.
This deal.
And you want to be paid. But I've already paid $10 in administrative expenses for the PAC out of the money I generate here in the U.S. I only send back $90. You get the $90. You don't get $100.
All right, so now I'm the foreign parent and you're the domestic subsidiary because I was going to do it the other way around. But that's my point, actually, is that I otherwise would have owed you $100. Now
I'm the U.S. subsidiary.
Yeah, I'm sorry. US I keep getting our roles confused. I keep thinking you're the foreigner and I'm the U.S. person. You would otherwise owe me $100. Now you only owe me $90.
So where's the disbursement under your theory? Where's the disbursement?
Who
dispersed the money?
My point is that you are effectively paying for that extra $10.
Out of U.S. revenues, yeah.
Or am I paying?
And
now
you're trying
I've
to make
lost
that
our
illegal.
Rules again.
But they're paying their administrative costs out of the proceeds from U.S. revenues.
Commissioner Barrelin?
I don't mean to interrupt, but
no, go ahead.
I think,
go ahead.
But I share Commissioner Weintraub's view that if the understanding of the transaction that is reflected in the alternative draft is incorrect, we want to know that. But it seems to me, as I read this transaction, that the costs are borne by the foreign company because it is never reimbursed for the full amount of the car that it sent over. So it's getting only $90. And so there's a $10 cost that was originally paid by the U.S. company that is now being accepted and borne by the foreign company because you're not getting the full $100 for the car.
Well, the only thing you're missing is that the expense was not born in Germany. The expense was born here in the U.S.
Well, it was first born in the U.S., but at some point there is...
And always born in the U.S. and never returned back to Germany.
But the company in Germany is not getting its full $100, correct, for the car. It is being reduced by the amount that has been spent in the U.S. on the SSF costs, which is, as you describe it, a recoupment of that administrative cost.
Accounting matter, that's correct.
And on that basis, it's my view that, and that's why I support the alternative draft as amended in the addendum this morning, that is a reimbursement by a foreign corporation. Money is fungible, but there is a credit. There's a credit that's going that is not being paid by the domestic corporation to the foreign corporation. Thank you.
Commissioner McGann.
Let's stick with the hypo for the $100 Mercedes. Must be stripped down. $10 remains generated domestically, never leaves the U.S., stays here. Right? My guess is it's not really $90 that goes back. There's probably, for the sake of hypothetical, $60, $70 goes back because the dealer – what stays here is the profit, right, that's generated here. It seems like an accounting method. I'm trying to get – it's not really just a simple – it's not as simple as an accounting method. I've bought cars. The sticker price is never what you pay unless you don't know any better. And then there's the first guy, and you cut a deal with him. Then the other guy comes out and says, well, no. You know, you got to pay for the undercoating, and then, you know, 6 hours later, and I'm sure Mercedes dealers don't do all that. I'm painting with too broad a brush, right? This is for $100. I guess I can't afford a Mercedes, but it seems to me that in the world of cars, to sort of look at the car and the cost of the car is kind of a red herring, because it seems to me that there's it's more of a profit issue and what stays here and what goes home, and what stays here is what you're using to administer the PAC. So the PAC is being administered by U.S. money. It's not foreign money administering a PAC. Am I on the right track, factually?
I think that's correct, and I don't want to portray myself as an expert in the automobile industry, but the accounting between MB USA and Stuttgart is not an accounting based on retail sales, because sales are made by retailers, right? I mean, the cars come in, the company sends them to the dealers send them, sell them, you know, and then there are markups and profits, hopefully, all along the way. The accounting system that's at issue in this opinion is just how the company keeps track of its expenses and profits between the U.S. and Germany as an accounting matter. And there is money that goes back to Germany, but it's only with respect to the cost or the charges, the wholesale charges, presumably. Again, I don't want to profess expertise here, but the charges between what are basically two arms of the same company. They're just trying to keep track of that money and whether or not a profit is being made. Now, we can certainly provide the commission with additional details from experts at our client, if that is of desirable to you all. I do think that there is a fundamental issue, as we point out in our comment, as to whether this type of accounting is necessary at all is a legal matter. And that, of course, it's never been undertaken for the last 30 years, ever since the Portland Cement decision in 1980, which the alternative draft seeks to explicitly overrule with another opinion, all of which was covered in the 2002 rulemaking before this agency. I realize none of you were here, but I was. And, you know, whether the McCain-Feingold had changed the rules for PACs was a big deal. And the commission, I think, correctly concluded at that rulemaking that none of these rules were changed. And the insertion of the words donation and disbursements as the co-sponsors of BCRA stated in their comments at the rulemaking, had nothing to do with administrative costs. It was focused on soft money donations by foreign nationals to state candidates and political parties. That was your donations. And secondly, they were concerned about so-called independent expenditures or electioneering communications, both at the federal and the state level. They didn't want foreign national money being spent. And that concept was incorporated into your regulations, specifically.
Commissioner Weintraub.
I'm not sure that I agree with that, because I went back and I wasn't here, but I went back and reviewed the explanation and justification for that rule, and it seems to me that what they're talking about really is the issue that I referred to before, is that that had been a longstanding subject of debate before, whether this was okay for the domestic subsidiaries of a foreign parent to even have a PAC. But if you can point me to a place in the reg book that says, I mean, you said it specifically addressed it. So where is the place in the reg book that specifically says that the foreign parent can subsidize the administrative expenses?
Well, I can only point to the rulemaking that was issued by the commission and the final rules, as well as the comments that supported those decisions. And it says, thus, the final rules do not define indirectly or contain additional rules pertaining to U.S. subsidiaries of foreign corporations. And I think that that language in the commission's own comments at the final rulemaking may have been based in part, at least, on numerous other comments that were submitted in that rulemaking, including the comments of Senators Reid and Ensign. And on page 2 of their comments, they said, existing law and commission rules are fully adequate to keep foreign corporations from contributing to federal elections through their U.S. subsidiaries, and there was never any suggestion to the contrary during the long efforts to enact campaign finance reform. And they were underscoring that we didn't change anything about foreign national participation except to make it clear we didn't want them to be making donations, which they had to define because they were not contributions, right? A donation by a foreign national to a candidate for governor is not a contribution, because the contribution is defined by the act as to a federal election official. And they're not expenditures because they're not in connection with federal elections. So what do we call them? We call them disbursements. And the comments from Senators McCain and Feingold basically made that point. He said, we were not talking about PACs. We were talking about soft money. And we didn't want that foreign national money creeping into our state and local elections. And that's why we inserted this terminology into the statute. And even the Campaign Legal Center said, you know, you, the commission at that time, of course, it was none of you, have asked, you know, have the rules changed? You know, we're surprised that you even asking the question, because they didn't. And that was their comments. So this is not an anomaly of some sort. It's not as though this was some issue that was overlooked. It was a broad question of how did McCain-Feingold change the rules regarding foreign nationals, including subsidiaries and their PACs. And the commission concluded to change it in just inserting these two words. Now, of course, the commission was required under BCRA to conduct a rulemaking and to determine what had changed as a result of McCain-Feingold. And this was the conclusion in this particular legal area. And if the current commission believes that this should be somehow reexamined because maybe something was overlooked, the proper vehicle for doing so is not this advisory opinion. Proper vehicle for doing so is to initiate a new rulemaking and let all those folks who are affected by this come back in, including Portland Cement, which is the organization that established the principle that you don't have to sort of figure out every organization's accounting method and figure out which money comes from where. The issue is it a U.S. corporation? Is it here in the United States? If so, it can have a separate segregated fund. And administrative costs have forever been exempt from the definitions of contributions and expenditures in 441B, and McCain-Feingold did not seek to alter that by inserting these two words, donation and reimbursement, or disbursement, in McCain-Feingold.
Commissioner Weintraub.
And that is a very learned argument, but none of it, but it is not true that the regulations specifically address the administrative costs that may or may not be borne by foreign parents. It is not specifically in the regs. If it was there, you would have just told me, yes, it said, you know, section blah-de-blah-de-blah. And I mean, I don't want to get into an argument with you about this, but my point is that I believe that the topic was generally addressed. I believe the focus was on, again, the long-standing issue that had been a subject of debate, and you know, there was a clear interest in putting it to rest forever, the notion that a domestic subsidiary could or could not have a PAC. And that's been settled, and I think that's what they were talking about. I think this is a lot less clear, and, you know, I could go on, you know, about the distinctions between this and the Portland Cement Company, which had, you know, 45 member corporations, 34 of which were United States corporations and 11 of which were Canadian, as opposed to this one, which is wholly owned by a foreign. I could, you know, I personally, my favorite thing about the Portland Cement Company is the AO is the Portland Cement Association AO is the number, 1981-11. In October of 1980, they were issuing their 111th AO, and here we are in July. We're such pikers. We're only working on 2009-14, but that was clearly a very busy year at the commission. But I think what this establishes is that this is a principle that has evolved through AOs. It's never actually been codified directly and specifically in the regulation, and that's why it's still a question. If it had been directly and specifically addressed in the regulations, we wouldn't be having this discussion, because if we had a regulation that was clearly on point, then you're right, we would not be able to use an AO to say, well, the regulation doesn't apply. But, you know, we have a you know, we clearly have a disagreement over what the law means, as well as what the facts mean here. And I don't know where to go with it from here, because I think the positions are fairly clearly delineated.
Mr. McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Back in the earlier AOs, they had cutting-edge questions like, disclaimers, and it was amazing what people got AO requests for, and there were hundreds.
And they were nice and short, too. I love that about them.
Well, that's what I was going to actually note that. If you go back and look at old AOs, they're quite short, and the turnaround was quite quick. But as the bigger issues get decided and you can drill down more and more, it seems like the more detailed the issue, the longer the request is and the longer the response is. And you know, I think actually Mr. Barron was here then, too, literally. I think he was an EA for a commissioner probably when that AO was decided.
I had just left. I'm sorry.
You had just left. Okay. All right. I was close.
But those were the good old days.
Well, I take your word for that. But I think there is disagreement, and I think it illustrates different approaches to how different commissioners approach an issue, and Commissioner Weintraub raises the reg book and says, well, show me where it is in the regs. And when the answer comes back, well, it's not in the regs, I say, well, that means it's okay. And it seems to me that sometimes if it's not in the regs, you know, my default tends to be that that means, well, if it's not prohibited, then it's permitted. And that brings up the AOs and the meaning of AOs. And I think if nothing else, this illustrates, you know, how folks can approach the same issue differently, you know, and how you balance different sources of law. For me, in this AO, the money is generated within the U.S. It's domestic money. There is not foreign money being used to administer the PAC. And I think factually that's the case. And I hear the argument on, well, the reimbursement or whatever word you want to use for it. But I think it's not like money's coming from a foreign country to administer a PAC in this country, which I think is really the big policy concern. To me, to not say yes here, I think, is a retreat from what the commission had done in the past, and I think the requester lays this out in his comments. The McCain-Feingold thing and the meeting of Bicker to me is somewhat of a red herring, because I'm of the school that McCain-Feingold changed a lot, but it didn't change this. And this was an argument that some had used who opposed McCain-Feingold, was that it was sold as a soft money ban, but really it didn't ban soft money, because corporations and unions could still use soft money to administer their PAC and still do restricted class events and still do restricted class advocacy, expressly advocating candidates' election or defeat, all using soft money. So it really didn't ban soft money, and this was one of the attacks people used. So to me, it's not really much of a debate as to the meaning of McCain-Feingold. Certainly, they strengthened foreign national ban, but that, I think, was addressing specific allegations raised regarding specific campaigns prior to the passage of Bicker that had nothing to do with administration of PACs. But for me, the money originated here, so it's American dollars. This is an issue that's going to come up again, I think, probably with cars, right? Because there's more and more non-domestic car dealers, car manufacturers, who are starting to build their cars here, create jobs here, and that sort of thing. And I think as that sort of globalization continues, this is an issue that's going to come up again and again and again and again. And I think we're going to have to come to grips with it. We either could say, no, you can't administer your PAC, or maybe come up with more of a workable, and maybe that is a workable solution, but something more akin to the what's I think is the evolving nature of certain industries. But that's my piece. But it just
thank you.
I'm not really disagreeing. We're just starting from different premises, and so we land in different places, I think.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support the, I guess, the non-alternative draft in this case.
The mainstream.
The mainstream, yes. Draft, that's right. something that Commissioner Weintraub mentioned made my ears perk up about how this issue has evolved through the AAO process. The alternative draft places a lot of significance on the fact that the foreign national contribution ban in BCRA was a game changer, and a game changer to the extent that now Portland Cement and the 1982-34 SONAT decisions are now going to be overruled if this were to be enacted. And I'm struggling to see how BCRA was the game changer and how this is going to alter the evolution of how we're going in this area. Requester set forth several pages of legislative history and recited those here about how the sponsors and those who supported BCRA did not envision and explicitly did not include any language which changed the governing framework for how domestic subsidiaries of foreign national corporations and how their PACs were going to be treated under the law. And the alternative draft basically just the extent of the analysis that I can see is that donation and disbursement are considered analogous to establishment, administrative, or solicitation costs without any further citation to any authority or any further explanation as to why they're analogous. And so when I look at that extensive legislative history versus just the bare assertion that they're analogous, I just can't make that leap that somehow BCRA was a game changer in terms of how domestic subsidiaries are going to be treated, how they're going to pay for their administrative costs for conducting PAC activities. So for that reason, I'm on the mainstream draft in this particular matter, and I share Commissioner McGann's concern that this is going to be a matter that's not going to go away, but that's only going to continue to come up, and we're going to have to address this, whether through the AO process or maybe through the rulemaking process, but I'm afraid this is not one that's going to go away quickly.
Further comment? Commissioner Weintraub.
I just want to reiterate that I said this before, but I just want to make sure that because of something that Commissioner McGann said, that everybody is 100% clear that nobody is suggesting that the domestic subsidiaries can't have the PACs. And, you know, it's almost like, I don't know, it's I compliment you for being very full in your description and in your and in the facts that you laid out before us. But it's almost as if the facts that were laid out were the, you know, the EAPP cost center pays for the administrative costs, full stop, we wouldn't be having this discussion. The issue is raised because of what happens next, which is that, and they get credited for that when they next have to send in their car payments to Stuttgart. And I see your brow is wrinkled, and I know that, you know, we just are not, it's just one of those things where we're just not seeing it the same way. The fact that it goes on the books as opposed to somebody literally writing a check is not dispositive, in my view, because the effect is the same. There's, you know, more money here and less money there. But it is, as you say, an interest, you know, and I was trying to think about this and saying, well, what, you know, what's the advantages? What's good about allowing this transaction to go forward? Well, it's certainly administratively easier for the corporate entity, and that's, you know, I don't belittle that. You know, that's a concern. People need to be able to run their businesses. And it is, you know, it's true. It's not a contribution. The administrative costs of running a PAC are not a contribution. That is true as a matter of law, but it is still a subsidy. And it's a subsidy that we allow for U.S. corporations and for labor unions with respect to their PACs. And then, you know, the question is it, what's the good argument for saying that it's equally okay for foreign companies to be subsidizing the operations of a U.S. PAC? And I couldn't come up with one on the other side. You know, there's, as I said, the administrative and the running the business, and I get that, but I just couldn't come up with, you know, the alternative is, and I think that BCRA does reflect this, is there's an unease with having foreign money in any way subsidizing the U.S. political process, and that's, you know, what you're seeing reflected here.
Further comment? Commissioner McGann.
Just fine. To me, it sounds like, If, for example, this was labeled a dividend and an expense, that sounds like it would be okay. But because it's a charge and a credit, that feels like the money, that's more feels like German money because it's being credited. Now, it's probably not just a simple term. It's not simply language, I guess. There's probably all sorts of tax implications and business structure issues and all kinds of reasons why they call it what they call it, but which is well beyond what we do here, thank God. But if they would pay to administer this PAC using, you know, dividends, profits, or whatnot, that would be okay, right?
If who would pay for it using which dividend?
The domestic company uses their domestic profits to administer the PAC.
Assuming that but then what's the next step? Assuming that there isn't some offset of those payments, as is described here.
Right.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, I mean, if they use it, you know, just it, right, okay. I just, thanks.
We're not saying they can't do it. They can certainly do it. It's just, you know.
The devil's in the details.
Yeah.
Okay.
Commissioner Hunter?
I would just like to hear from the requestor regarding Commissioner Weintraub's comment.
Well, which of those?
Sorry?
Go ahead. I'm sorry. If you know which one that was.
I don't know how to explain it any clearer, except I will try one more time, that we're not talking about a single foreign dollar paying for any of these expenses. This is all money generated in the United States. It's used to finance all their operations here, including EAPP and anything else. And whatever they send back, this is U.S. money going back to Germany. It does not include the expense for the PAC expenses. It would be, I was trying to think of an analogy as the commissioners were discussing this, and my thought was, I hope you don't transfer this concept to the other provision in the statute that prohibits the making of a contribution in the name of another. It would be like somebody going and saying, go ahead and make that contribution, and then I'll reimburse you for it. And they don't get reimbursed. Under this theory, they've violated that provision, even though no money changed hands. And that's what you're talking about as a factual matter in this request, because all of these other things are a matter of internal accounting to try and keep track of profit. Any money that actually goes anywhere is from the United States to Germany.
I have a couple of questions. Just on the control issue, what I see, though, is you have an LLC that's parent, in a sense, is the Daimler North American Corporation. And then the parent, of course, is Daimler AG. So you're talking about, throughout this whole discussion, we ignore the parent. We don't have any discussion at all. It's the Mercedes-Benz basically billing or invoicing the so-called grandparent. And then the money would go to Sterling Corporation, as I understand it, which is a Delaware corporation. Now, who decides how that money is going to get spent in the SSF, Sterling?
It will be, I believe, individuals from MBUS A LLC, and if there are participants from Sterling, there certainly would be permitted. But the reason it's attached to Sterling Truck is because it's a corporation.
Well, I understand that, and I'm just to me, the corporate structure has a difference, as far as I'm concerned, who's controlling the money, and in this case, who decides. The SSF is going to be held by Sterling, a Delaware corporation. But who decides how that message is going to be conveyed to the managers and the people who participate in the SSF? Who decides that?
Well, it will be the American employees in the EAPP here in Washington, who will organize the PAC initially, and I would have to confirm the extent to which others would be involved.
The reason that's a concern to me is who decides how the money's getting spent. And when you get in the SSF here, we have no information about who's on the board of Sterling. Typically, the board of directors of Sterling would decide who the officers are. And we don't have any information about who's on the board of the parent Delaware Corporation, what they call it, DNAC. But in this particular case, what I understand Sterling has, he has an SSF, and they get money from Mercedes-Benz to administer the PAC and maybe create it and maybe carry the message and all that goes with that. Well, is that correct?
That is correct. But the individuals who will be involved in the PAC will all be U.S. citizens, non-foreign nationals, who are within the eligible restricted class in the operations here in the United States. So the way that they are structured has a variety of operating companies. The chart that was submitted.
I know your chart by heart.
It is just a very simplified chart. I mean, there are literally scores of other operating companies dealing with parts, other types of vehicles, and so forth here in the United States. And, of course, if they are all affiliated entities, then any restricted class individual working anywhere in that corporate universe would be eligible to A, be solicited, and also eligible to participate in a PAC.
Well, just to go a little further, at some point somebody has to make decisions for the entity that has the SSF. And typically if you have a company, an American company, the board of directors controls the corporation, employs the officers, and from that the corporate message is developed. To me, if we're talking about the use of foreign money owning a subsidiary, the justification for allowing an American subsidiary to have its own SSF is so that it can act independently as an American corporation. And yes, okay, profits go to the foreign country, but they have an independent base here. In a case like this, one of the things that concerns me is the Mercedes-Benz is an LLC. There's no board of directors, per se, to our knowledge, and they react directly to the German corporation, not even to the American parent. So they build the German corporation together. They build Daimler AG.
They go to Daimler North America Corporation.
Well, that's not what I'm – the way I read it is the invoice Daimler AG directly.
For the accounting. And
for the accounting, yeah. Exactly.
But Daimler North America Corporation is the entity and the sole partner of Mercedes-Benz USA LLC. And as we set forth in our request, no foreign nationals will participate in the operation of the Political Action Committee. We are going to abide by all the commission's former advisory opinions, assuming no more would be reversed or overruled, in ensuring that the 22,000 U.S. employees, many of whom are eligible to participate, will be the only ones who will be participating here.
I understand that, and I don't think, as Commissioner Weintraub says, have a quarrel with the concept that's now established at this point. My only question is, who controls the money? And in that particular case, could a German company have an SSF? No. Why? Because we don't want that kind of control in the United States as a matter of policy. When I look at this now, I see Daimler as a direct entity that provides the credit to the grandchild, not the parent, which is Daimler.
That's true of every U.S. subsidiary that's 100% owned ultimately by a foreign company. That is true of every U.S. That's why the rules are set out the way they are. And by the way, it's the way that the former Daimler-Chrysler PAC was operated for a decade.
I understand that, but an LLC to me is a little different than a corporation in terms of how it gets run. We treat an LLC as an individual. We don't treat a corporation that way. So... And that's part of the reason.
I think it's a disregarded entity with only the Daimler North America Corporation as the sole member of the LLC.
Correct.
Yeah.
And who's on the board of Daimler North America?
I'm sure that's public information. Be glad to provide
it. We don't know. Yeah, to me it's an issue. Why is would you agree that if the check was written directly from Daimler to Mercedes-Benz, our argument would be different here?
Well, then you would be addressing the longstanding Portland Cement type situation, which that organization, by the way, in its 2002 comments, which was 22 years later than the original advisory opinion that everyone has relied on, stated that approximately 80% of the domestic Portland cement production is manufactured by U.S. subsidiaries of foreign corporations, all right? So it's an association. 80% of their members are U.S. subsidiaries of foreign corporations. They have all that money coming in. Back in 1980, they, of course, had foreign members as well. I assume they were Canadians. So you have this entity that's got money coming in from foreigners. Now, I would suppose, in part speculate, that would be an issue for lots of corporations, not just wholly owned subsidiaries of foreign corporations. I mean, Ford Motor Company sells a lot of vehicles abroad, generates a lot of foreign money. And I'm assuming a significant portion of that comes back to the United States.
Well, the big point of your argument basically is that the money, there's no money going to Germany. The money is staying here. It's not a matter of I mean, and that the German money isn't being spent on the SSF, but the origination of the program is really the credit. The credit originates in Germany. The incentive originates in Germany to spend on an SSF. Otherwise, what would a subsidiary do that unless there was a credit of their own? Commissioner Hunter.
Sorry, I don't want to interrupt your line of questioning, Mr. Chairman. If you're not finished.
No, go right ahead.
I was just wondering if before we call for a vote on this, it might be of interest to any of the other commissioners to potentially ask requests or to provide some additional information along the lines of the questions that we've just talked about, ensuring that no foreign money is being used to administer the PAC. And it sounds like there might still be some discrepancy of the information that's being provided. I don't know. I'm just trying to look for a possibility. And another thing is that this meeting was sort of called a little bit hurriedly, and so one of the alternative draft was submitted, I believe, Friday afternoon. I could be wrong on that. So it might be of interest to commissioners to hear from other corporate PACs, if that's something that might be persuasive to them, to find out if this may actually be a game changer. So I'm wondering if there's any interest in sort of holding this over, maybe in the future, if the requester would agree to do such before the vote today.
If that's a question to the requester, then is that what you had in mind to ask for, to see if there was an attitude?
Either to the requester or to my colleagues.
Commissioner Bowerly.
I guess from my perspective, I don't think that there's a additional factual information. I think we understand the transaction. I think I take a different view of it. My view is that this credit transaction results in, while not a transfer of money reimbursement, as described in the request, a recoupment of the costs that were originally paid by the domestic corporation. So I don't believe that I have any. I think we just take a different view of the meaning of the transaction as been described.
Mr. Weintraub.
I think to some degree we're just kind of talking past each other. As Commissioner Bowerly said, we just see it differently. Although, I mean, I don't want to, if we held it over and in the meantime we got, a raft of letters from the corporate PAC community and a letter from McCain and Feingold saying, no, that's not what we meant. Would I find that persuasive? Well, yeah, I might. And you're right, we did, the meeting was, the date was switched. We didn't get the drafts out as promptly as we aspire to. So I don't want to say there are no circumstances in which I would ever change my mind on this. If we held it over and we got two letters in saying, oh yeah, this would really mess up our operations too, would that change my mind? I don't know. But I don't want to foreclose it. And I hold open the possibility that maybe I'm just wrong about this. Like I said, maybe a bunch of members of Congress would write it and say, what's the matter with you? Would I find that influential? Yeah, I would, if I'm misreading what was going on there. But like I said, I think we're just trying to be very sensitive to the concern about not allowing foreign money to subsidize U.S. politics. And if, if Congress really wasn't going there, my problem is it's all sort of inferred. This particular issue I don't think was as specifically addressed as perhaps might have been more helpful to us. But, if you want to hold it over, I'm not going to object to that. I don't know that it will be ultimately productive, but, it's...
Mr. Vice Chairman.
I think part of this equation would be requester's counsel to find out whether or not, I don't know where we stand on the 60-day clock, but I'd assume our next scheduled meeting is not for about a month, so we'd probably go over that. So I think we probably need to tie in requester's counsel into this discussion to find out whether or not having an extension is a possibility.
Just to contribute to the conversation on scheduling, the August 4th is the day that the 60 days runs, and I don't believe our next meeting is until the last week of August, so we would need to inquire of the requester as to his ability to give us an extension.
I'm confident if you need more time, my client would grant it to you.
In hopes of a better result.
Then is there a motion? Or is exercise my own discretion? What would you like to do? Mr. Hatter. I'm told we don't need a motion. I hear no objection to holding it over. We will hold the matter over. Thank you, counsel. It's very helpful. We'll reconvene. And Mr. Couser, are you on the phone and able to hear?
I am on the phone and I can hear. Thank you.
Well, you're coming in loud and clear. This works. You're kind of a guinea pig in some respects because this is the first time we've had this kind of participation on an advisory opinion and certainly by telephone. So welcome.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the courtesy in making the phone connection available.
Thank you. It's glad to have you here. Mr. Vice Chairman, we have already submitted a document. And let the record reflect we're on agenda document 0955, and we have a late submitted document to that, I believe.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda document number 09-55.
Thank you very much. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? 6-0 in favor. We have a presentation by Mr. Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda document 09-55 contains two draft advisory opinions that respond to a request submitted on behalf of Bill White for Texas and Barry Hunsaker, its treasurer. Bill White for Texas is the principal campaign committee of Houston Mayor Bill White for the 2012 U.S. Senate election in Texas. The current holder of the Senate seat has announced that she will not be a candidate in 2012, that she intends to run for governor of Texas in the 2010 election. As a result, she may resign her seat, in which case it is most likely that a special election and runoff election would be held to fill the remaining portion of her term. The White Committee seeks guidance as to what steps it may take now to raise funds that may be used for a special election in the event one is called, and what effect the use of certain fundraising language will have on its ability to redesignate funds from the 2012 elections to any special and runoff elections. The White Committee's first question has to do with the use of undesignated contributions. Both drafts conclude that any undesignated contribution may be used for a special or runoff election without having to seek redesignation from the contributor, because the special or runoff election would be the next election after the contribution had been received. The second question has to do with contributions that carry an alternative designation, stating, for example, that the contribution is designated for the special Senate election if one is held, or for the 2012 primary if no special Senate election is held. Draft A concludes that such a designation would constitute an appropriate designation for either the 2012 primary or a special election, because particular elections are described. Draft B concludes that this language would only designate contributions for the 2012 primary election and that the White Committee would have to seek contributor redesignations in order to use these funds for any special election because the occurrence of a special election is too speculative to be considered a particular election.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Comment from Council, from any commissioners? Not. Do we have a motion? Hearing no motion. Seeing no motion. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Yeah. Well, if we're looking for a motion, I would move that we approve advisory opinion 2009-15 draft A.
Thank you. Any comment? Commissioner McGann.
Just one quick comment regarding the comments that were filed. One comment raises a question about the reporting and tries to say that we're requiring two different designations for each contribution. I don't think that's what we're doing. I think if you check one box and you either pick primary or general, and then you're asking for memo text to sort of let the public know what's going on here. So I'm not sure that comment really is reading draft A correctly. And just, it's not really a question for the requester, but we've read your comments and we understand your concerns. But the flip side is the contribution limits are the statute, and the reporting is the statute, and you know, this is not the typical thing that comes up, and the reporting regime is I think, in my view, the best balancing of the various interests, and I certainly hear you. I'm very sympathetic to
the idea you have to go back to contributors and all that, and that's difficult. And you know, having been in your shoes before, I can certainly appreciate that. But the flip side is we have contribution limits and that sort of thing that we have to maintain here. So, you know, it's not really a question, but the comments have been considered. You're not here. I'm sort of looking at the ceiling as if you're sort of coming out of speakers. People are laughing at me. There's, you can hear the laughter. But we've considered the comments, and the suggestion I would have is once we go through with this and you begin actually doing this, I would probably keep in contact with your reports analysis division analyst and make sure that you're all on the same page on how to report this, because to me that's the trickiest issue of all. The good news is you know, I'm going to support the draft that says yes, you can raise the money. And given you're not sure when the election is and a moving target, you're going to be able to raise money in a way that reflects that political reality. But the reporting issue is a little bit more difficult for us to navigate because, you know, it's certainly any reporting takes time. And in this case, we've read your comments and we're trying to balance all the interests. So that's all I want to say. So the person, the requester who's not here, and I'm not going to look at the ceiling again. Knows that you know he's been heard.
Thank you, Council. Any further, Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I join in Commissioner McGann's comments.
That's good, doesn't it?
There's a phrase you don't hear every day.
And Ken Doyle's not here to see.
I know, bummer. Maybe he's outside somewhere. I also, you know, I'm sympathetic to the questioner's concerns on that, and you know, but ultimately I'm going to support draft A. I do urge this requester and anyone else who might take guidance from this AO to be really careful, hire good staff. There is the potential of up to five separate elections that could be coming up, and just managing the money for that many potential races, even though we're only being asked about the first two this time, you know, there could be more, and it could get very complicated. And we have seen candidates and campaigns that made mistakes and got in trouble, and you know, it's they've got money in the bank and it's tempting to use it, except that they're not quite at that election that it was designated for, or they don't keep the accounting properly. And I'm not suggesting that this requester would make any of those mistakes. I'm just saying that this is inherently a very confusing, very complicated situation. And I urge all of the candidates who will be involved in this race to exercise care going forward, because we don't want to see you again in another division.
Thank you. Any further comments? Do you have a motion?
Motion's on the table.
Okay. I forgot we already had a motion. We had comments on the motion. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much, Mr. Kowser.
And thank you for connecting.
We're on the advisory opinion of 2009-16. Council.
Agenda documents.
By the way, welcome to to this table. This is very nice to have you here. And let's see, your name is Theo Lutz, and this is your second year student at Indiana from.
I graduated undergraduate from Indiana University. Uh-huh. I'm a currently student at American University.
American, excuse me. And, yeah. So welcome to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, commissioners. Agenda document 0951 responds to a request for an advisory opinion by Mr. Michael Johnston, who serves as the treasurer of the Libertarian Party of Ohio, or LPO. Mr. Johnston, on behalf of the LPO, seeks the commission's determination that the LPO qualifies as a state committee under the Act and Commission regulations. In support of his request, Mr. Johnston has submitted documentation indicating that, one, the LPO is the sole affiliate for the state of Ohio on behalf of the Libertarian National Committee; two, the LPO placed a candidate for federal office
on the 2008 general election ballot, and three, that the LPO performs activities commensurate with the day-to-day functions and operations of a political party at the state level. Also, please note that the Commission has recognized the Libertarian Party as a national political party in prior advisory opinions. Agenda Document 0951 concludes that the LPO qualifies as a state committee under the Acting Commission regulations because the LPO has established that it is part of the official party structure of the Libertarian Party and that it carries out the day-to-day operations of that political party at the state level. Thank you. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. That was a nice presentation. We do have a late submitted document, Mr. Vice Chairman.
I would move that we suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda document number 09-51.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion passes 6-0. Is there any comment from the commissioners? We have an objection. No. Commissioner Weintraub.
No, I was just going to say, in light of the articulate and persuasive presentation of counsel, that we dispense with any further discussion and move to adopt agenda document 0951.
Thank you very much. Mr. Vice Chairman?
I will support that motion. I did want to ask counsel about, you know, the history of the Act's treatment of local minor parties throughout the history of the Act, but we're getting close to lunch, so I will... We can go straight to the motion, so maybe a later time, Mr. Lutz.
Would you like to come back after lunch?
I'd be happy to.
I don't think we'll call you on that. Commissioner McGann.
I intend to support the very articulate and persuasive motion made regarding the very articulate and persuasive presentation made by counsel.
Thank you very much. Is there any further comment? Well, we have overwhelming support, but I'll call for a vote anyway. All in favor? Do we have a motion? Let's see, we have the motion. All in favor?
Yes. Aye.
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 Motion passes 6-0. Congratulations.
Congratulations to the Libertarian Party of Ohio for signing up for this.
Okay, we're on agenda document 0953. Mr. Ginsburg, welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. We have a late submitted document, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda document number 09-53.
All right, thank you very much. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion passes 6-0. Presentation from Cheryl Hemsley. Ready to go? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, good afternoon, I guess. Agenda document 09-53 responds to a request for an advisory opinion on behalf of Romney for President, Inc., the principal campaign committee for Governor Mitt Romney's 2008 presidential campaign. The committee requests guidance on the disposition of funds remaining in its campaign accounts that represent uncashed refund checks issued by the committee over a year ago for excessive primary contributions. The request asks if the committee may donate the funds to the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, a charitable organization, and if not, must the committee disgorge the funds to the U.S. Treasury instead? There are two drafts before you. Draft A concludes that the committee may not donate the funds to the foundation and requires the committee instead to disgorge the funds to the U.S. Treasury. Draft B, on the other hand, concludes that the committee may donate the funds to the foundation. The commission received one comment on the advisory opinion drafts from the requester. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Any comments from commissioners? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to start from the same ground where Commissioner McGann started on a different matter, and that's what do the Act and the Commission regulations have to say with regard to this proposed activity? And And in this case, it really doesn't speak, the Act nor the Commission regulations speak to the proposed activities. And when that's the case, then the presumption should be that the proposed activities that are made by Romney for President in this particular AO request should be presumed to be permissible. And I have not been able to identify any other authority that would push me in a different direction. Draft A tries to draw analogy between the requester situation. Requester was not a a presidential candidate who received public financing of any kind. We do have regulations on the books that say if you participate either in the primary matching funds program or receive funding for the presidential general election, that if you have stale refund checks, then those have to be disgorged to the Treasury. And which makes sense in that circumstance, because in that case, the candidate is receiving a substantial federal subsidy from the United States Treasury. And so for stale dated checks to be returned to the Treasury or given to the Treasury makes a lot of sense, since in light of that subsidy. That circumstance doesn't present itself in this current request. I mean, we have a stale dated check issue here, and there's stale dated checks mentioned in that circumstance, but to me that's not enough to say we can draw an analogy, and therefore we should draw the conclusion that disgorgement is the necessary outcome in this particular advisory opinion. I also, when looking at past advisory opinion requests, this request I think is more in line with the 1991 Alphonse D'Amato advisory opinion, where you had a committee that received potentially illegal contributions in the name of another, and the commission could have then also said they need to be disgorged to the Treasury, but the option was given to either disgorge to the Treasury or to donate to a charitable organization. And I think that these current – that the facts in this matter are more similar to the D'Amato AO than they are to the 2003 AO revolving around then-Senator Bob Smith. So that long and short of it is I am planning on supporting Draft B. I think that that is the correct answer. I don't see anything that that would push me in another direction. So that's how I'm going to vote.
Thank you. Any comment? Mr. Weintraub?
Somebody has to speak on the other side, I guess. This is a difficult question because, I don't know, maybe this is a case of easy questions making hard law as opposed to hard questions, or maybe it's a hard question. The problem is that it's a very appealing question. One wants to say yes. It seems like such a nice thing to do. Here he is. He's such a good guy. He can't even give back this money. People won't cash the checks when he tries to give back their excessive contributions. So what should he do with it? He wants to give it to this great charity that's doing all this wonderful medical research and probably helping sick children. And, you know, you just feel like, What a churlish person one would have to be to say no to a request like this. So I feel bad about this request, but I guess I see the analogy more closely to the Bob Smith AO from 2003, which was a unanimous decision of the commission in 2003. Where the candidate had asked whether he could use the money for a nonprofit organization that he was setting up. Now, one could draw the distinction and say, well, this isn't a charity that he was setting up. And I started to think about how could one carve out enough restrictions on this that maybe I would feel comfortable saying yes. Because I think one of the difficulties with political contribution, with charitable contributions by candidates, is that they're often done for strategic reasons. They're often done because they are politically beneficial to the candidate. One could well imagine a charity that's entirely unrelated to the candidate, say the I threw this one at my colleagues recently. I got a phone call the other night from a policeman who was soliciting funds for the sort of the widows and orphans funds of fund for officers slain in the line of duty, very compelling charity. Now, if a candidate had excessive contributions, and remember, this is one of these odd situations where you have to be very careful about your language. We're not talking about excess contributions, because that would be clearly covered by 439A. We're talking about excessive contributions, which basically the candidate is not supposed to have. They're not permissible. So, you know, suppose a candidate had some of this money lying around and didn't know what to do with it and said, I know, I will give it to the Widows and Orphans Fund, and as a result, maybe in the next election, the Policemen's Union will support me. Or I'll give it to the local hospital, or a lot of members of Congress have scholarship funds in their own districts where they like to give money out for scholarships to worthy students in their districts. And these are all wonderful things to do and perfectly permissible if you're doing it with under 439A with leftover campaign funds that are lawfully raised and you're allowed to keep and use for those permitted purposes. The problem is this is money that he's not allowed to keep, and everybody understands that he's not allowed to keep. So then the question is, to what degree do we feel that he can control what he does with it? I mean, it's not true that just because there isn't a rule or a law on point that he could do absolutely anything he wants with it. Clearly, there are some things that we would take issue with. He can't put it in his pocket. He can't. We probably would say no if he wanted to give it to the national party committees, which otherwise would be permitted under 439A, or make other political donations with it. So there are some limits, you know. So where do they come from? And my concern is that while I fully believe that this former candidate is acting out of the best of intentions and because he wants to support a worthy cause, I have a hard time figuring out how we could cabinet in so that we did not create a situation where other candidates would be able to use funds that they were not supposed to have in the first place, or at least, you know, in the last place. Maybe when they came in it was ambiguous, but by the end of the day it was clear that this money was excessive. How could we ensure that other candidates not be able to give to other charitable organizations that they felt would advance their political interests? And I don't think we want to be in the situation of saying, well, this charity's okay, but that charity's not. This charity's national, that one's local. I think we're better off just saying you can give it back, you can give it to the Treasury. Basically, those are your options. And I say this with some regret and with a great deal of respect for the good work that Mr. Romney's trying to do here, but I think that's why I support draft, which draft is my draft, A. Without any implication that there's any bad motives at all going on in this case, but I think that for the sake of, you know, having an appropriate set of rules that will apply even-handedly to everybody, that's the better result.
Thank you very much. Further comment? Mr. Weintraub.
Excuse me. Mr. McGann.
People confuse us all the time, Mr. Chairman.
He looks like
yes.
Yeah, birds of feather.
For me, the Act and the regs don't directly speak to this issue. And it kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier. When that's the case, when the Act and the regs don't prohibit the proposed conduct, that means it's okay. I hear Commissioner Weintraub with the idea of you know, politicians could essentially take excessive contributions, give it to some charity, get some political bang for the buck, and you know that's difficult to cabin in. But I'm not so sure the answer in this case is to mandate that it goes to the U.S. Treasury. Policy matter, it seems odd to me that campaign has taken excessive contributions, which is a rather slippery concept. I mean, the campaign guide has many pages on handling illegal contributions, and we have presumptive redesignations, and you know, it's not the limits are indexed for inflation. It's not a simple analysis anymore as to whether something's excessive or not. You think it would be, but I don't think that's necessarily always wrong, because I think, you know, part of that was driven by the practical reality of people giving money and that sort of thing, and trying to allow folks to raise money yet maintain the statutory limits. But the idea that a federal agency can then render an opinion saying, well, that money has to go to the U.S. seems somewhat odd, which made me think about it a little bit more. And then I took a look at the fireman case with the Federal Court of Claims about disgorgement, and then I thought, well, what we really have here, I guess, is sort of unclaimed property, right? They've given the money back. People haven't cashed the check, so you have this money sort of unclaimed. And unclaimed property, to go back to sort of law school property class, is that word escheat, which no one really knew what it meant. But the chair probably knows. He's smiling. Yes, he knows that word. That's, yeah. And it seems to me if it's unclaimed property, it escheats to the state governments, not the federal government. I don't know of any time where money escheats to the federal government. So if we sort of look at this as unclaimed property and it can't go to charity, I'm not so sure the U.S. Treasury is the place where it goes. Where the people live, maybe that state holds it. I mean, I guess you could get money orders and just send out the money. Then you're just giving the money to a bank, you know, and I guess the bank makes the money. But, you know, you have a campaign that wants to do the right thing, I think, and get rid of the money. And it seems odd that the only option is the U.S. Treasury. You know, this is different than trying to transfer this money to a party committee or somehow use it in connection with a federal election. I mean, I think giving money to charity has been seen on the outside as a fail-safe way to remove money from the political system that is questionable either politically or legally. And it seems to me that that's not a bad option, given the other options. But I'm a little stuck on the authority to say that it has to go to the U.S. Treasury when I don't see the act or the reg saying that. And then if we're going to see it as sort of unclaimed property that doesn't have a home, I'm not sure the federal government gets to bring that money home. I think that money doesn't belong to us being the government. But maybe those who have practiced more in the state system have more of a sense of what might be a better home for this. But giving it to charity, I think this is much. This I look at the D'Amato AO. And to me, that this seems to be an extension of that. So I think the money can go to charity. But assuming it can't, I'm not so sure how we get to say, well, we just give us the money and everything's under control.
Further comment? I have to line up with Commissioner Weintraub on this, mainly because I look at the money as money that doesn't belong to the campaign committee any more than anyone else, and therefore, and it's certainly not our money, it's not legal money, it's money that's supposed to go back, money that should not have been accepted in the first place. And so who are we to designate where it can go? Now, I do think the estate argument makes sense in here, but the illegality of the possession of that money comes from a federal statute, so maybe that's where the most logic applies. But I'm reluctant for the commission to get into the business of trying to decide whether it's this charity or another charity or whether it's the state or that kind of thing. From just a jurisdictional point of view, I just don't see where we have the ability to designate that money, which doesn't belong to the committee and should have gone back or maybe should have never been accepted. But it goes to the original donor unless – if we open up a policy saying from now on the committee can use that money in any way it wants or any 501c3 it wants, I think we really don't have the authority to do that at this point. So it's not an easy question. I grant there's no sure ground here. Commissioner McGann.
It made me think of a question I have for the requester. I always like to think about kind of what the word on the street is and how things are perceived and what folks perceive the law to be. And, Mr. Chairman, when you said that, at least I took from your comments that we would somehow be allowing this to happen and opening up this avenue, I'm not so sure that's the case. And I think there's giving money to charity is something that I think many people think you can do. And I guess the question for the requester is two parts. Why is giving to charity essentially the right answer? And then two, why is giving it to the U.S. Treasury something that is not a good idea?
Well, thank you, Commissioner. I suppose implied in at least the second part of your question is it a conflict of interest for a federal agency to insist that excess funds be sent to itself to
pay for it at the exclusion of Treasury. And while I think that the conflict policy of the Commission is something for all of you to determine, I think that the notion that somehow this request, which in sort of a departure for me, really is a bipartisan request, because I do think that at least there have been press reports of committees, including Democratic committees most recently, giving excess funds to charities. We didn't feel confident in making that recommendation because the statute is silent about it, because the Commission has never addressed this particular opinion, this particular issue before. I would only say that I think the right answer about charity is that the statute and the regulations are silent. The Commission has not dealt with this before, because there is sort of the patina of a U.S. government agency deciding it gets all the money as opposed to a recognized charity. And lastly, because this isn't breaking new grounds, that there are provisions in the regulations in the statute that permit campaigns to give funds to recognized charitable institutions. And that definition of charitable institutions and the practices that go on a regular basis are the same ones here. We're not asking to give excess funds to national party committees, nor to any entity that would engage in federal election activities, nor is this a situation like Senator Smith, where it was a charity he set up himself, which I think is different. But more importantly, in the Smith AO, the money he wanted to send were general election contributions, and he wasn't a candidate for the general election. So in our minds, there would not be any issue about that. Nowhere in draft A, nor in any of the comments, has anyone cited any authority that would not permit this money to go to a recognized charity. And so for that reason, it seems that a legitimate alternative for all campaigns in this situation, especially because the only regs that are cited deal with publicly financed campaigns, and this was not a publicly financed campaign.
Thank you, Mr. Ginsburg. Commissioner Bowerly?
I didn't want to interrupt if there were follow-up questions, but thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the reasons expressed by Commissioner Weintraub and the Chairman, I'm going to support Draft A. I want to just note that I think that neither D'Amato nor Smith are squarely on point, which is, I assume, why we have the requester here. But this comes down to me that these we're not dealing with excess funds, we're dealing with excessive funds. And if the committee has determined that these funds would result in excessive contributions from their donors and it's tried to give them back, it is left with money that it should not have it does not have legal authority to use for any campaign purpose, as it's acknowledged, because it's tried to give them back. And I appreciate that that can be a pretty onerous burden on a campaign, as in our mobile society people move and it may be difficult to track people down. But because those funds were not within the pool of funds that the Commission was supposed to have and to be able to execute its campaign purposes, in my view, it can't direct those funds to any other purpose, including a charity. And I share Commissioner Weintraub's view that this is a particularly hard case because it is a great charity and they do great work. And I appreciate that the committee and the former candidate have, you know, tried to find a good place for this. Unfortunately, I just don't see the way clear to that, because I don't think these are in the same category of excess funds as Mr. Ginsburg was just discussing, and what the right and we clearly permit excess funds to be used in a number of specific ways. So in my view, the distinction between the money itself is what makes the difference in this particular AO. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner. Further comment? Commissioner Weintraub.
Short comment. Just want to point out what I think everybody in the room knows, which is that we don't get to keep the money. It will go back to the Treasury and will not in any way enhance the budget of the FEC, and certainly, you know, won't increase our salaries. But with absolutely no hopes of a positive result, but because I think we need to do this procedurally in order to conclude the matter, I will move approval of Draft A in AO 2009-17.
Okay, thank you. Any comment on the motion? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion deadlocks. Commissioner Weintraub, Commissioner Bauerle, and I voted in favor. The Vice Chairman, Commissioner Hunter, and Commissioner McGann voted against. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Expecting the exact same result, I would move that we approve with respect to Advisory Opinion 2009-17 that we approve Draft B.
Thank you. Any comment? All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No. Okay. The Vice Chairman, Commissioner Hunter, Commissioner McGann voted in favor. I and Commissioner Bauerle and Commissioner Weintraub voted against. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that procedural at this point, then we should instruct counsel to notify requester that the commission was not able to make a determination as to the request, and I so move it.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you, Mr. Ginsburg. Agenda documents 0952 and 0952A.
Okay. I would move that we
Good afternoon. We are in the afternoon process here.
Afternoon.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks a lot. As you know, we're experimenting with this process, and so it's nice to have you here. And we're learning as we go. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we suspend the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents in order to consider agenda documents number 09-52 and agenda document 09-52A.
Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes 6-0. We have a presentation from Ms. Gallagher.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Before you are two draft advisory opinions that respond to a request submitted on behalf of Penske Truck Leasing Company, L.P., Penske Truck Leasing Corporation, and Penske Truck Leasing Company LP Political Action Committee, also known as Penske PAC. The request asks the Commission whether Penske PAC is disaffiliated with the General Electric Company's SSF GE PAC. The connected organization of Penske PAC is a joint venture, of which Penske Truck Leasing Corporation is the general partner, and other Penske companies and several GE companies are limited partners. Under a recently executed amendment to the joint venture agreement, the GE Limited Partners reduced their ownership of the joint venture to less than 50%. Each draft first determines that the GE companies in the joint venture are not per se affiliated, and then each draft goes on to use the affiliation factors at 100.5G and 110.3 to analyze the overall relationship between the two entities. Draft A concludes that the entities remain affiliated and therefore their SSFs remain affiliated because the joint venture's primary source of funding remains a pre-existing line of credit between General Electric Capital Corporation, an affiliate of the GE Limited Partners, at below market rates and no less favorable than would be provided to a wholly owned subsidiary. Draft B concludes that the entities are disaffiliated and therefore their SSFs are disaffiliated because the newly negotiated terms of the line of credit between General Electric Capital Corporation and the joint venture may be seen as part of the process by which the joint venture is separating from the GE companies. The Commission has received one comment on Draft A and no comments on Draft B. I'm happy to address any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Any comment of any questions of the Office of General Counsel? Any comments? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hello, Carolyn Mark. I have no questions for you, but it's nice to see you. but I think we'll be able to give you an answer, which, you know, puts you ahead of some of the requesters today. I'm going to support draft B, and I appreciate the work that went on behind the scenes for folks to get to a place where I think we will have votes to approve it. I've seen a lot of affiliation questions over the years. They're usually not the most exciting things on our agenda, and they involve the fascinating questions of, you know, where under these 10 factors, how do they weigh, and because that those are the ones that we're asked. The per se ones are easy and usually don't get asked at all. And my general philosophy on these is that there are pros and cons to affiliating and disaffiliating. If you're affiliated, you have a larger solicitable class, you have smaller administrative expenses or consolidated administrative expenses, and you have one contribution limit. If you disaffiliate, you have a smaller solicitable class, double the administrative expenses, but you get two contribution limits. You don't have to share a contribution limit. So it's, you know, there's pros and cons to both situations, and I tend to think that if there's a defensible case for what the requester wants to do, then we probably ought to let people order their affairs in the way that makes most sense to them. And I think this was one of those where, you know, you could argue it one way, you could argue it the other way. That's why we have two drafts. But as I said, I'm going to support draft B and allow these groups to disaffiliate.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any questions other than to commend Ms. Lamb and Mr. Renaud on bringing the commission together after a sometimes fractious day, and I appreciate your patience.
You know, their colorful clothing, too, which are well-coordinated. That's very nice.
Very much so. I imagine there was some sort of discussion before this meeting. I too...
but not enough chit-chat to make them a political...
That's right.
Well said.
But like Commissioner Weintraub, will be supporting Draft B, and I commend Requesters Council for their very detailed and very, I think, persuasive request.
Thank you very much. Are we ready for a motion?
I'll make that motion. I move that we approve with respect to Advisory Opinion 2009-18, that we approve agenda document number 09-52-A, which is otherwise known as Draft B.
Thank you very much. Any questions? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.